ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just 40 years ago, racism was legal in South Africa.
You were a non-person. You were non-white.
I'm Sisonkem Simang. My dad was a freedom fighter against apartheid, and I grew up as part of a global movement to end that injustice. But I don't know much about what Australians did. So join me as I meet the Aussies who took a stand and helped change world history. ABC Rewind, Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Time for another science show. I'm Robin Williams. But today, if you'll allow, two mentions of ABC programs who featured science with such flair recently. Backroads, ABC Television, on Citizen Science, marvellously performed at Shark Bay in northern WA. And here on Radio National, Saturday Extra, with Nick Bryant's engrossing piece with Tim Flannery on those two glorious possums, once thought to be extinct, but now seen again alive. Good news, right here. And later we'll have the chap whose tummy produced its own alcohol. And that news from Shark Bay about the seagrasses. But now those possums. The point is that our region, Australia and nearby, is more and more revealing of natural treasures that confirm how much we have to celebrate and protect. Tim Flannery of the Australian Museum tells me what the discovery really amounts to.
Well, Robin, the discovery wasn't made in Papua New Guinea, but in Indonesian Papua, which is the western side of the island of New Guinea, which is part of the nation of Indonesia. And within that area, the discoveries specifically were made on the Vogelkop, which is the bird's head, that big peninsula that sticks out of the western end of New Guinea. It is very heavily forested, but the original fossils came from an area called the Ayamaru Lakes, where there are caves, which people have inhabited for many thousands of years, and they're full of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of bones. And among those bones in 1999, Ken Applin, my dear friend, now deceased, sadly, found two bone fragments that could have fitted on the nail of my little pinky finger and decided that they were exceptionally important, one being the jawbone with, I think, one tooth in it, of a long-fingered possum, previously unknown to science, and the other a gliding possum, relative to the greater glider. And I remember I looked at those two fragments and thought, Ken, either you're a genius or you're crazy. I don't know which. Turned out he was a genius. He got it all right from the beginning, that those fossils were animals correctly identified, thought to be extinct because they were between 6,000 and 7,500 years old. But we've recently just discovered them as living animals, which is amazing, I think.
Where did you find them?
We found them in various locations around the Vogelkop. The long-fingered possum, we still don't understand its ecology well enough to be able to predict where we'll find it, but there are a couple of locations in the north and then east of the Vogelkop Peninsula where it's turned up as a living animal. The gliding possum is very much like Australia's greater glider in that it depends upon tree hollows in the largest trees of the rainforest for survival, and wherever logging has occurred, it becomes extinct. So again, we're desperately trying to map its distribution so we can understand where its remaining habitat is and to try to protect that.
What sort of relationship do these animals have with Australia? Because going way back, the land was almost joined or was completely joined.
Well, this is one of the great surprises of this research, that we have found fossils of these very same animals in Australia during the Pleistocene period. So they occurred in Australia at a time when diprotodons roamed the land and other species of megafauna were about the place. We thought they'd become extinct with the megafauna, but then they've turned up several hundred kilometres to the north on the Vogelkop as living animals. So what that tells us is that the Vogelkop has acted as a refuge for some Australian supposedly extinct marsupial species. And perhaps that's because the western slopes of the Dividing Range, where there was once very extensive dry rainforests, all those forests have been lost and replaced by eucalypts over the last 40-odd thousand years. And perhaps the Vogelkop is the last refuge for those animals and a forest that they can live in.
What about the local people there? Are they scientifically minded in that sense to be rather excited by this discovery?
Well, the people that we've worked with most were only contacted by the outside world in the 1960s. So they're still very, very traditional in the way they live and the way they think. And for them, the gliding possum particularly is a very special animal. It really is the centre of their cosmology. And I think part of the reason for that is that it inhabits the tall kauri forests. These forests, the trees are so large, four people can't put their arms around them, that these people consider the centre of the universe, the place where all life originated. And this animal is very sacred to those people, so sacred, in fact, that they won't mention its name quite often. So it's hard to collect any information about it. But we have managed to find out things from other areas.
But it sounds as if they'll look after it anyway because of those reasons.
Well, yes, they would if they were left to their own devices. But the trouble is, of course, all of that forest is vacant Crown land as far as the Indonesian government is concerned. It's a bit like Australia pre-Mabo. It's all just owned by the Republic. Thank heavens that the Indonesian government, however, has brought in a program called Hutan Adat, which is their version, really, of Mabo legislation. And we're working with the Global Wildlife Fund and the Mindaroo Foundation to try to gain ownership of the forests by those local clans and then put in place a sustainable pathway for development and conservation for those people.
The big story, actually, following up from your previous work with the opalised fossils we talked about in the Science Show about a year ago, pushing back both the diversity in this huge continent and its neighbours, as well as the more amazing ancientness. This really is a landscape waiting to be properly discovered, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I really do encourage my younger colleagues to think of New Guinea and its surrounding islands as part of the Australian landmass. And biologically and geologically, particularly the Vogelkop, is part of Australia. So that's still to be explored. Imagine an area a bit like Tasmania, but in the north, you know, with its own endemic fauna, poorly researched. What an opportunity for young people to get out and do some exploring.
Getting the people, there's lots of work to do. So sign up to the universities and so on. But the final thing is, I've got possums in my roof and they come down to see me every evening and they're very lovable. Are these two creatures you found still lovable?
They are extraordinarily charismatic. So the long-fingered possum is boldly striped in black and white. It'd fit in the palm of your hand. It's about twice the size of a sugar glider. The ringtail glider is a bit bigger than that. It's about half the size of Australia's smaller, greater gliders. And it is unbelievably beautiful. It looks like a little leppy lemur. It's got a very cute little face. We've got a photograph actually taken by some local researchers of one peering out of a tree hollow, resting on its elbow, which is kind of my favourite.
Finally, any chance of new species of tree kangaroos up there?
Not on the Vogelkop, but there are still some prospects in the rest of New Guinea where perhaps one or two final species may remain to be discovered.
Congratulations, wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Professor Tim Flannery at the Australian Museum. And if you're wondering about that long finger's function, when the possum puts its ear to the trunk of the tree in the forest and hears possible lunch wriggling in its burrow, the possum can then chew a hole in the tree and put its long finger down the passage and extract food fresh as you like. By the way, you can admire the possums on the Science Show website in their living glory. And so going all the way northwest to Shark Bay, and a reminder, do see the two marvellous Backroads programmes, especially the first one a few days ago. What was so exciting was the effort to recover the immense spread of seagrasses once so abundant in the area. Those grasses, as we've mentioned often before, absorb and store 40 to 100 times the amount of carbon, even as tropical rainforests do. Here to explain the range is Jennifer Verduin, who is Pro Vice Chancellor at the College of Environmental and Life Sciences at Murdoch University in Perth. I've said on the Science Show so many times about seagrasses, how they absorb gigantic amounts of CO2, but I didn't know how many different sorts of species. Tell me, Jennifer, how many are there?
So worldwide, there are about 60 or 70 species of seagrasses. In WA alone, there's about 26.
How do they vary?
Their morphology, so they can look different. They can be blade-like, like we know our grasses, or with multiple little leaves on naked stems. Yeah, various other sizes, lengths.
So varieties like that, are they individual plants like we imagine a grass would be, or are they all connected underneath?
It depends a little bit on the species. So some of species grow clonally, so they're one clone and they grow vegetatively, so one shoot actually comes out of the stem and then grows further, or they sexually reproduce, so they produce fruits or seedlings that can grow on the actual mother plant. So some of them are like Amphibolus antarctica, to go for one of them, it's my favourite seagrass. They grow seedlings, so they're viviparous, so they're pollinated, and the female plant then grows the seedlings on the mother plant.
Did you say in the Antarctic?
The species name is Amphibolus antarctica.
How do they grow in such a hostile environment?
So they have a good root system and rhizome system that actually holds them in with the sediment. Then when they grow, they actually reduce the currents, so the water is so slowed down, and that allows sediment to settle in the meadows, and that builds up the sediment. And this then they can actually robustly sort of root it, literally, in the environment. But it depends on the area they are. So in very protected areas in the ocean, and shallow areas where you have Holophila species, or paddleweed as they're known sometimes, they have a much lesser root system and they are much more in a less dynamic environment, whereas the bigger seagrasses, they can actually withstand much more wave action and things like that. So,
well, listener, you can infer that, of course, you're talking to someone who's got a good physics background. In other words, you can look at a plant as a wonderful physical system. And one of the things that is really famous, as we found out in an interview with Michael Weir, who is the first Indigenous person to win Prime Minister's Science Prize, because he was talking about ways in which the carbon is kept underneath the grasses. How do they manage that?
The roots are keeping the sediment in place over many, many years. Some of these seagrasses are hundreds of years old, thousands of years old and established, and they've accumulated this sediment and it sits there forever. And in that sediment, it holds the carbon for a long time. So when you refer to Michael, he was saying that in the heat wave in 2011, 2012, something like that, where a lot of the seagrasses disappeared, so they're now no longer with these seagrasses disappearing, they cannot hold the sediment. And then you have areas where the sediment just gets resuspended within the water column. Therefore, carbon gets released into the water column, into the atmosphere.
So we really need to protect those seagrasses around the coastline. Is it the entire coastline of Australia?
Mostly, yes. Depends a little bit. So in more temperate areas, you may have more kelp areas, but most of the seagrass do occur along.
As you travel around, as you just indicated, looking at all these different species, do you find that in most areas these days, in 2026, people know what to do with their seagrasses to look after them?
I don't think so. I think the awareness is increasing at the moment. I think here in WA we do well with community citizens and making people aware with certain programs. Yeah, so I think it's increasing, but I don't think everywhere people know what to do with it. I think for a lot of people, especially the larger seagrass, it's just those horrible things that you have between your feet when you go in and walk
in. It feels squidgy and nice, and that's a nursery for fish.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very important. And they clarify the water as well. So the water is much clearer when because they hold that sediment and particles within the meadows, as we call them. So, yeah, they are very good for lots of things.
And without drowning the school pupils, it's just the sort of thing I think you could do very usefully, taking the kids out from school for a couple of hours to look at such things. And, well, of course, the permission so that you don't drown too many pupils, you'll have to get organised. But nonetheless, it's the kind of thing that would open the minds of young people and they could do some very useful things just like that.
Yeah, and we do a lot of outreach programs also at this university. We often go to schools as well to tell them there are certain areas. Seeds for Snapper is one. That's not what we personally do, but Ausfish is involved in that, where they take the community out to collect fruits, for example. They then get dehusked, so the seeds are remaining, and then those seeds get dispersed by community members as well. So
they have those fruiting bodies as well. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so certain species of seagrass, they produce fruit. Fruits float up, so surface currents take them much further away. So the strategy is to disperse their genes as far as they can. And then when they're ready, the husk comes off and the seeds has a little keel and it sinks down so that it can fall flat on the surface, on the sea surface, and then it sort of sprouts.
Clever grasses. Mm. Now, where is your work taking you next?
Hopefully Shark Bay, where we'll be doing lots more seagrass restoration. So together with Michael, we're hoping to restore that. And personally, I would love to be able to do this work all along the coast, all the WA coast, and restore many of our seagrasses.
There are so many different aspects of trying to do something as it happens about climate change. Looking after the seagrass is for itself valuable in many sorts of ways. But if you add all these different things that could improve our fight against CO2 going up, combined, it could be the answer.
Combined, yeah. I mean, if you plant more seagrass, it clarifies the water, it contains the carbon, it also could possibly have a cooling effect. So, and of course, as we know that the oceans are warming, less gases can be contained in it, so that's not a very good thing. And then more gets into the atmosphere as well, because the ocean can't contain it anymore. So if we can do things partly with seagrasses to cool the water, that would be fantastic.
And it's happening at Shark Bay, as Pro Vice Chancellor Jennifer Verduin just described. She's at Murdoch University in Perth, and that recovery effort was shown inspiringly on Back Roads, ABC Television, just a couple of weeks ago. The Science Show on Radio National. The news on possums in Papua was a reminder of the often surprising wealth of nature and human history in our Australasian region. Here's more on our ancestral history and another reminder of the scientific value in looking so carefully where much was assumed before, in case much, much more is there all along to astound us once again. Here's Professor Sean Ulm from James Cook University in Cairns. Ulm, Professor?
It's French-Austrian. My great-great-uncle was Charles Ulm, who was co-pilot to Kingsford Smith, flying the Southern Cross across the Pacific from LA.
I'm glad I asked. Ulm. Just three letters.
Not many of us, in Australia at least.
Let me take you to Lizard Island, where we've been several times, you more often than I. And when I was there, it was at a time when you were celebrating the excavation of what was a midden on the island where many, many people, indigenous people, had had, if you like, a sort of picnic. But you dug down. Tell me the story of how that was dug down and what you found.
Actually, it's a long, long and involved story, Robin. But over many, many years, we worked with Dengal and Ngarramukku traditional owners to uncover the really deep history of Yiguru, or what we call Lizard Island. And early on, we got involved because pottery fragments were found in the lagoon underwater by a colleague of ours, Matt Felgate, who's a New Zealander at the University of Auckland. And we went back and did a lot of work all over the islands, but we didn't find any more pottery. So our focus really turned to recording other types of cultural place. And I don't know whether on your visits to Lizard Island you've seen the amazing stone arrangements everywhere. Turtles made of stone, whales, dugongs, manta rays. In fact, we've recorded over 1,000 of them now. So our focus really turned to recording the cultural landscape and supporting traditional owners in what they wanted to do in terms of management. And as these things often do in a full cycle, after working there for more than a decade, we circled back to excavating and trying to find out that deep history of Lizard Island. How long had people been there and other things? And we were speaking to the directors of the Lizard Island Research Station run by the Australian Museum out there, and they reminded us of a place they'd seen many, many years before. So we dutifully went out to the place pointed out on the map that Lyle Vale had pointed out for us. And fortuitously for us, a cyclone had come through there in 2014 and uprooted a whole lot of she-oak trees. And we could see the midden shells. So these are huge reef-flat species like giant clams and trochus shells, indicating that a midden was there.
In other words, someone had had a picnic way back and put the shells down and it went deep.
Very deep, as it turned out. We began excavating, and in archaeology, we excavate in very thin units. And in fact, we excavated that midden in 2-centimetre layers. So we went down very gently, 2 centimetres at a time, all the way down to more than 2 metres below the ground. So it's actually one of the densest middens on the whole of the Great Barrier Reef.
And when you first went out there talking about finding bits of pottery, did you assume there were European bits left out, you know, by some ship going past?
It was an open speculation. So Matt Felgate, who originally located the pottery back in 2006, he'd actually worked in Roviana Lagoon in the Solomons as part of his PhD. And he thought those pieces of pottery might indicate that Lapita voyagers had come to the area.
Lapita pottery from the islands way to the north?
And to the east. So Lapita pottery is a very distinctive form of pottery, often with a red surface and fingernail impressions. Very distinctive when you see it. And the first people to really voyage into the Pacific to New Caledonia, Fiji, Vanuatu carried that type of pottery with them. There was no evidence that those voyages had come west at that time, but plenty that went east. But the other complication was the pottery was found underwater in the intertidal zone of the lagoon. And we know that there were a lot of European ships, people bought into the sugar industry, bought in, kidnapped from islands in the Loyalty Islands and other places. So there's shipwrecks and other things. So the pottery may well have come from other places. So it raised a big question for all of us. Where did this pottery come from and who made it?
And so you went further and further down. How deep?
Well, we ended up at 250 centimetres below the surface, and the cultural material, so the midden material, went down nearly 2 metres. So even our tallest students were underground by that time and couldn't see out. But what was extraordinary, there's so many firsts about this midden for the Great Barrier Reef and for coastal archaeology in Australia, that that midden fills in the whole headland. So in fact, this headland before people got there would have been a series of granite boulders, some of them quite big. And over time, in fact, what the radiocarbon dates showed was that people had lived there at least 6,500 years, if not 7,000 years, and built up that midden continuously over thousands and thousands of years. And in fact, the most recent radiocarbon dates suggest that people were still living there when Europeans were there in the 19th century.
6,000 years. When I first came to Australia in 1964, they told me that people had been in Australia for 4,000 years. Now, when you went, 6,000 years down in the midden, pottery.
Yes, indeed. Well, the pottery around 70 centimetres below the ground surface, we began encountering small pieces of pottery. Frankly, we couldn't believe it because we weren't looking for it by then. We'd given up our search for pottery, having not found it elsewhere. And we kept digging, and between about 70 and 80 centimetres below the ground surface, we found more than 80 pieces of pottery. Now, we were astounded. Nothing like this had ever been found. And it was clearly found in an Aboriginal midden. Aboriginal people had, as you said, camped at this place for generations. And the pottery was firmly embedded in this long-term camping place.
Since we talked about that a while ago, someone, I think your good selves, of course, may have been involved in analysing the constituents of the pottery. And when you examined the bits you first mentioned and what was found down deep, was it all made from the same stuff or what?
So in the midden, we looked at the geological composition of the pottery sherds themselves. So pottery is made up of two things generally. You've got the clay and then you've got the temper. So clay is clay, but temper can be many things. In Europe, it's often salt and things like that. But in the Pacific, it's often sand or crushed up coral or shell that you'd find on the beach. So if you look at the clay and the temper, they're very distinctive to the location of where the raw materials come from for the pottery to be manufactured. So we then worked with marine geomorphologists to look at what does the sediment from Lizard Island look like, and is it the same as the temper and the clay in the pottery? And for those sherds in the midden, it was 100% match. Every single sherd that we analysed had clearly come from clay and temper from Lizard Island.
If you got different results from the other pottery, this would in fact back up something that was, those years ago, an exhibition in one of the Queensland museums showing that people who came, Indigenous people from the north and also from Australia itself at the time, were coming and going. In other words, it wasn't a case of affected by gravity, everyone moving south on the map. But there was mobility and interaction. Is that right?
Absolutely. And this is, our recognition of this is extraordinarily recent. It was actually only as recently as 1940, Fred McCarthy from the Australian Museum was publishing saying that hundreds of innovations had come from New Guinea into Australia, but none went the other way. So over the decades, and particularly my colleague Ian McNiven at Monash University has been working with traditional owners and Torres Strait Islanders in particular to investigate what he's coined the Coral Sea Cultural Interaction Sphere, which really characterises that complexity of movement of people from perhaps as far south as Cairns all the way up the east coast of Cape York Peninsula across Torres Strait and into southern New Guinea. And of course, in southern New Guinea, that Hiri trade connects you all the way through to the Bismarck Archipelago and beyond. So it's a total, over the last 50 years, a total reconceptualization of seeing Australia as isolated in the world to one inverting that and seeing Australia as intimately connected to the rest of the world.
And perhaps trading, who knows, ideas, objects, traditions.
Oh, and DNA. And I think the recent work showing the relationships between Northern Australia, Arnhem Land in particular, and Makassar, that long-term trade of what's now in eastern Indonesia, annual fishing people coming for the trepanging and sandalwood and other things, looking at the deep traditions of that, that it's not just a couple of hundred years old. Again, my colleague Lynette Russell at Monash University has been doing a very detailed study showing that this has gone on for centuries, and Aboriginal people voyage back to those islands back and forth. And I think it really challenges that traditional view that certainly was around when I was an undergraduate student studying
when Captain Cook discovered Australia.
Indeed, indeed. But, I mean, this is only 30 years ago that, you know, we had a concept of Australia as very isolated. And I think even when we made these pottery finds, which were announced 2 years ago in 2024, there was some pushback from colleagues who really thought that these should be Lapita, that they should be from the Western Pacific rather than from Australia. And I think there's a denialism of Indigenous technological complexity. And the people, the Dengal ancestors who made this pottery, were traders. They were knowledge seekers and holders. They were inventors. And they clearly knew how to make the pottery. And they were connected to those alliance systems, to bigger pottery making communities, perhaps along southern New Guinea or further afield. And they were applying that knowledge on their local country using local raw materials. And I think that's the extraordinary part of the story.
Yes, extraordinary. The stature of Australia in the global scene naturally is ever more complex and interesting than once was assumed. Sean Ulm is Distinguished Professor at James Cook University in Cairns, Northern Queensland, and Director of the Centre of Excellence for Indigenous and Environmental Histories. The Science Show on Radio National. And so we come to that fellow who produces his own alcohol internally, though he hadn't chosen to be so inflicted. And the cure is equally diverting. Meanwhile, in your own biome, how many different creatures or microorganisms do you imagine you have in your long gut? I asked Professor Nandita Garud at the University of California, Los Angeles.
No, in fact, if you want to know how many microbes are in our guts, people have actually tried to quantify that.
And found what?
It's roughly on the order of 10 to the 13.
Which in real language is what?
A lot.
Trillions.
Yes. And we can actually try to understand the most common prevalent bacteria in our guts because they're the easiest to sample. And we can try to understand how are they evolving. So it's not an entire black box and sea of data. There are approaches to start to understand this data.
And are they affected very much on what we happen to eat? Would the biome change fairly quickly, do you think?
Yes and no. So scientists have found that bacteria do change, especially if you travel to countries like India. People get traveler's diarrhea, for example, and they've noticed an uptick in the amount of antimicrobial resistance genes, say, in your gut. However, one really nice feature about our gut microbiomes is that they're also really stable. So while they might endure perturbations, they can rebound back to their original state. If you hit a microbiome with antibiotics, it can actually rebound back to its original state. And this is, I think, a good thing for us because what has worked for us will stay with us, even while we go through perturbations.
Now, when we come into those foods, obviously heard about on programs such as the Health Report with Norman Swan, the ultra-processed foods. What makes a food ultra-processed in your definition?
My understanding is that there are additives to these foods and they have these special carbohydrates that allow them to last far longer than a fresh fruit, for example, would last. They include foods that have syrups, that are chips, sodas, etc., and just are really things that you wouldn't grow in your garden.
You grow them in a factory instead, with all sorts of unusual things happening to them. But will they affect the biome in a way that you can study yourself?
So I think that this is an active area of research. And what we are starting to find is that there are lifestyle and diet changes in industrialized populations that have changed the genetic composition of our gut microbiota. I don't know on what time scale this occurred. I don't know if a person who suddenly one day starts eating ultra-processed foods will suddenly see that adaptation. But I think this is a collective change that has accumulated in our populations over several decades. So what we're noticing is there are special adaptations that have risen to high frequency in these bacteria and have traversed the industrialized parts of the world and are absent from non-industrialized parts of the world. And that these adaptations are at loci or positions in the genome that are responsible for digestion of carbohydrates. One particular case study that we found was case study at a genetic position that encodes a gene that can digest a compound called maltodextrin. When we came across this, we didn't know what maltodextrin is. But my intrepid PhD student, Richard Wolf, fabulous reader, and he found that it's a compound commonly added to ultra-processed foods. If this is truly an adaptation to industrialized diets, then this adaptation should be absent from non-industrialized populations. And he found that indeed that was the case.
And the point about the interesting aspect of the science is one, but also we are affected so much, even with our brain working and so on, behavior by the makeup of that microgenome, as you call it. And so tracking that is very important, but with so many bits, how do you begin to sort them out in your work that you're doing now?
That's what fascinates me. So as we said, the microbiome is very complex. You have 10 to the 13 cells, of which there are at least 100, maybe up to 1,000 different species, of which there are many strains of the same species, of which there are tens of thousands of genes within each species. People call the microbiome our second genome. And it's this other part of us that's super complex and super dynamic, and we don't really know what it's doing. And my former postdoctoral advisor, Katie Pollard, she likes to say, we're in the era of the year 2000 when the human genome was just completed. And we didn't know what those genes were doing in the human genome. And so we're starting to discover that in the microbiome. And so we can use many bioinformatics techniques to start simplifying and whittling down the data. But once we have something that looks like a nice genome, we can start to think about what are the processes that are changing these genomes and try to look for those signatures in the data that allow us to see what we are after. So in the case of adaptation, we're looking for something that's passing from genome to genome, or host to host, And so we expected that this should have a fair bit of homogeneity, despite there being a sea of heterogeneity in the surrounding parts of the genomes.
How do you then begin to apply that knowledge, apart from doing simple things such as people at home learning what the ultra-processed foods might be with their mysterious ingredients and trying to have more straightforward foods?
So I want to clarify one thing that I have been pondering for a long time. I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing that we have adaptations in our gut in response to ultra-processed foods. Maybe it's actually a good thing. It's enabling us to actually digest those foods that we have access to. And so I wouldn't worry if your gut microbiome looks more industrialized versus non-industrialized. Maybe that's okay. And it's just adapted to what you have on hand.
I love the common sense in what you just said.
Right. So
we've got to apply common sense when we're buying our food.
Exactly. And so I think the microbiome is one readout of our health and what's going on. People have shown the connection between our diets and all sorts of other facets of our health, like our mental health. And so if you feel strong and good and your doctor is giving you a thumbs up, I think you should keep going. But again, if you feel like you could improve, then you don't need a microbiome readout to tell you that. You can probably make those choices.
One example of the complexity of digestion and such like, story I came across the other day, which I think you know about, which is a guy somewhere, I think in Britain, whose gut produced its own alcohol. And then they decided to treat it by giving him a fecal transplant. In other words, someone else's poo provided. Did it work?
Yes, that's a really fascinating story. It's called auto-brewery syndrome. And
auto-brewery. In other words, you're making your own grog.
Exactly. And it's unfortunate for the individual who has the syndrome because they're basically drunk all the time and it really impedes their quality of life. But indeed, they gave a fecal microbiome transplant. And as far as I understand, this is not a trivial thing to do because you need to clean out the microbiome of the person's gut. And so sometimes when you give a donor's microbiome, you don't know what's going to happen to the resident microbiome. Maybe the resident microbiome might stick around even if you try to clean it out with antibiotics and it might outcompete the invading microbiome. Or maybe the invading microbiome might actually succeed. And so I think the feat that these doctors achieved was quite remarkable.
Indeed. I think one of the pioneering works was on was it Clostridium difficile?
Yes, C. difficile is one of the pathogens that can cause gastrointestinal distress, and fecal microbiome transplants commonly work for C. difficile infections. So seeing FMTs work in other contexts is very nice.
Wonderful work. What does that teach you finally about how evolution works?
Well, I think we're still joining the two areas of work, translational and then also evolutionary studies. One day, what I think would be wonderful is if we could inform what kinds of fecal microbiome transplants people are receiving using evolutionary guided principles. So, for example, if we know that there's a special gene that's adaptive and perhaps could even help the human host that we're trying to help, then we could select strains to include in the fecal microbiome transplant that has that adaptation, instead of just randomly grabbing anyone's poop from a so-called healthy individual and giving it to that person.
Your intestinal genome, a continuing story. Incidentally, I turned out to have 10 trillion microorganisms in my tummy, and I suspect you're the same. And there's also a hierarchy of best fecal donors, according to the New Scientist magazine, and the best are often selected for further donations. Nadita Garud is Associate Professor at University of California, Los Angeles. This is The Science Show, and I'm Robin Williams. And earlier I praised two ABC programs for bringing us striking news about possums and then seagrasses. But the next example is both timely and somewhat worrying. On Tuesday, the Ambitious Australia report was released on our dismal support for national scientific research.
And on Radio National Breakfast, Sally Sara talked to Academy of Science Chief Executive Anna Maria Arabia about its significance.
How significant is this report and its recommendations on R&D in Australia?
This is a much anticipated report. An independent panel was tasked with assessing the current system and looking at ways to reverse the decline, where funding for R&D has been declining now for the better part of a decade. And it is such a significant report because it provides us with a really clear-eyed assessment of the strengths and weaknesses of the system. But really importantly, it provides a coherent roadmap forward. It gives us what we need to create an R&D system that is humming and that can support growth in our economy and, of course, improve the living standards of Australians.
When we're comparing Australia to the OECD, why are we so far behind when it comes to the amount that's invested into R&D as a percentage of GDP?
The decline's been ongoing for more than a decade, and I think it has been a result of incrementalism in the country. So we have had an R&D system which now has had many band-aids applied to it, a small fix here, a small fix there. But overall, that has not seen the sort of efficiencies and investment that we've needed to create a really robust system. So that's eroded over time. The other reason is that most other countries around the world have increased their R&D spend because they recognise that to respond to the sort of disruption we're going through now, that's technological disruption, environmental disruption, and the need to make the energy transition and geopolitical disruption, key to all that is investment in R&D, new industries, new technology.
What's the potential cost to Australia's future living standards if we don't get this right?
The cost of future living standards is enormous. So we know that when we grow our economy, we improve productivity and living standards improve as a result. Australians see what science and technology deliver for them. They see it through the solar panels on their roof and lower energy costs. They see it through the food on their table. They see it through health outcomes that they experience through medicines. We know that when we improve productivity, living standards improve as well. But it's not just us saying it. The Treasurer says it. Robin Denholm, who chaired this report, states as much in the report. Now's the time for delivery. Now's the time to reset this. In fact, the time to create this R&D system was 35 years ago. That was the best time. The next best time is right now.
Is the investment, does it need to come from the public sector or the private sector or all of the above?
Sally, we need to work in partnership. So underinvestment in R&D is multifaceted. We've seen underinvestment by government over the years, but we've also seen significant underinvestment by the business sector. They themselves are aware of this and recognise this issue. And there are many settings that need to be reformed to enable and incentivise greater investment by the business sector. These are well laid out in the report. The higher education sector is also a contributor. They're doing quite well in comparison to the OECD. Really importantly, we've got to move really quickly to start the hard work of implementation, and that requires all of us to work together, government, business, the research sector, the higher education sector, to create the best possible R&D system that we can possibly muster because our economy and our living standards rely on it.
Anna Maria Arabia is Chief Executive of the Academy of Science with Sally Sara on Breakfast, as the report Ambitious Australia was released on Tuesday. And yes, for some time we've reported Academy President Professor Jagadish saying Australian science is broken. Now is the chance to put it right, or else. And now to show how micros can be very entertaining, as well as in your tummy, here's a performance scheduled for Australia, including at the World Festival of Science at Brisbane. Meet the tardigrades.
These are scientists. Their job is to ask questions, questions we don't know the answers to.
So the show is basically these scientists find this tiny little creature.
Tiny!
A tardigrade.
Also known as a water bear, also known as a moss piglet.
Aww!
And they decide to put it through a sequence of very difficult environments.
Experiment! Electric! Poison!
Including a desert, a lava-filled area, a very, very deep ocean, an extreme cold environment. And putting a character under extreme stress is hilarious when it's done well. And what can be put under greater stress than a tardigrade?
Gareth Davis plays one of the two scientists who have this microscopic tardigrade in their sights. The average tardigrade is about a millimetre. They're plump, with eight legs. At the end of each is a tiny set of claws. Small but mighty, tardigrades can survive temperatures up to 150 degrees Celsius and down to nearly absolute zero.
So actually that informed the tone of the show a lot, because we realised we could do things like effectively kill this tiny little creature and it would bounce back from anything.
Alive!
Claire Watson is the director of this stage show for kids, Moss Piglet.
I had been given the task of make a small show for Windmill. So I was thinking small, 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 tiny, microscopic, and got to tardigrades. And I just thought about the tardigrade as a story for young people. Young people are getting so much information about tipping points and extinction events. And to me, the tardigrade is a real symbol of hope and a real symbol of resilience. And it's a creature that has survived five extinction periods. So it felt like a really great story to be telling young people.
But in order to tell the story, Claire and Gareth needed to find out more about tardigrades and how they became so resilient.
We had a scientist who we Zoomed a couple of times. Damn, I wish I remembered his name.
I'm Mark Stevens from the South Australian Museum, senior researcher in terrestrial invertebrates.
Dr. Stevens first came across tardigrades in Antarctica about 25 years ago. But these little guys have been around since at least the Cambrian period.
So 500 million years ago, and they look the same as they do today.
Again, plump, eight legs. To me, they look like a mix between a caterpillar and a pig.
They're an amazing creature that's been highly successful. They are perfectly adapted to the environments they live in, and they live in almost every environment. They can cope with droughts, they cope with radiation, with pressure. They've been taken and exposed to the atmospheres of space.
There are a few ways tardigrades are able to survive all of this.
They have a ton, so they can survive in that for up to 100 years or more.
The ton is a form of cryptobiosis, which is a reversible state of suspended animation that sees the tardigrade dry out and shrink.
And their metabolism goes down to almost zero. They're able to stay in that state for, we don't really know how long, easily decades.
Tardigrades survive this cryptobiosis by creating special proteins that protect against DNA damage, radiation, heat, and freezing. Scientists hope that maybe one day we'll be able to mimic these extreme survival skills.
They're going to outlive humans by a very long time.
There's still so much we don't know about tardigrades. After all, there are roughly 1,300 species. But at least in the play, Gareth's job is to find out more through trial and error in a series of haphazard scientific experiments.
So we wanted the scientists that are doing these questions to be childlike.
Alive!
And so these kind of really goofy scientists hopefully have a childlike curiosity about all the bits and bobs and things they can touch and feel and burn and light and freeze and throw. Hopefully the same curiosity that the kids have at that age.
The science characters, they're kind of clowns as well, aren't they? And they're sort of like, if the tardigrade in the world is a kid, then they're the grown-ups.
No matter what the scientists do, the tardigrade survives. He's thrown into a volcano. Abandoned on the slopes of a snowy mountain. Submerged underwater to dance with a jellyfish. And sent to outer space.
T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal.
The kids see the tardigrade take off in a rocket as a cardboard cutout of Earth floats in the background.
3, 2, 1, 0. Liftoff.
One of the big things about this show that we were desperate to include and really have fun with was just the idea of perspective. The idea that this thing is microscopic and so tough. There's the metaphor of being a tiny little creature and being tough. But then there's also zooming out and being a human on a tiny little globe, on a tiny little solar system and a tiny little galaxy and whatever universe there is.
The great thing about being small is that your adventures are enormous.
So that was a thing that we really wanted them to get a sense of as well, is Imagine how big the world is if you were smaller than the head of a pin. Imagine how big everything would be. Now, if we look up from where we are now, imagine how extraordinary and big and endless that universe is that's looking down on us.
Wow.
Planet Earth, it is full of wonders. It may look tiny from where we are, but everything's tiny from somewhere. After all, it's just a matter of perspective. Now, zoom out.
Water Bears and Moss Piglets, a micro-performance by the Windmill production team at the World Festival of Science, and formerly at the Opera House as well in Sydney. Talented micros are everywhere, not only in your faecal transplants. So after our piece on gut biomes evolving just now, let's go macro and look for something from next week. How quickly the campus of your university can evolve, on green patches especially, most likely. And this example is from Pamela Yeh, is of little birds, very like our own sparrows. And could you tell me about your study on the campus evolution? Does it happen that quickly?
I worked on this population of juncos that invaded this urban area in San Diego. And even before then, we noticed that there were juncos at UCLA.
Boy, when you say juncos, that's not an Australian name, is it? What are they?
So a junco is a small, unstreaked sparrow, and the name comes from its genus name, which is junco. But they're a small, unstreaked sparrow. They're very, very cute. They're very common in the U.S. So most people in the U.S. would probably have seen them because they don't breed everywhere, but they winter in a lot of places in the U.S. And so they're just a very, very common bird. And of course, now they've started to colonize urban areas, more of us are seeing them. The subspecies that we have has a grand gray back and wings and a white belly, and they're very fluffy and very cute. And they're also called the snowbird because you'll see them popping around in the snow, and they're just really cute.
Pamela Yeh on how species evolve on big American campuses, and what's more, on urban settings in general. She's on next week in The Science Show, as is more on seagrasses with Belinda Smith.
Seagrasses are exactly the same as the plants that we have on land, except they grow in the water, in the ocean. They have leaves, roots, rhizomes, flowers, and they're actually more closely related to the plants that we have on land, like the ones that grow in our backyard, like lilies and orchids, than seaweeds that also grow in the ocean.
It's amazing. You and your colleagues recently studied different species of seagrasses that live along the Western Australian coast. Why did you choose to focus on those West Coast species?
Yeah, so as the ocean is warming, Western Australia is one of those regions that is a hotspot for warming. And we're also seeing more intense and frequent marine heat waves here. So essentially hotter warmers that are lasting for longer periods of time. So marine heat waves, you can kind of think about them as underwater bushfires. So it's an intense period of heat that warms up the ocean quite quickly, and they can last for weeks to months.
When you say heats up the ocean, what temperatures are we talking about here?
It can get up to temperatures up to 5 degrees above average. And 5 degrees may not sound as much in air temperatures, but in the ocean, temperatures are generally quite stable. So an increase in 5 degrees can be really impactful for the ecosystems and the things living below the ocean.
Well, I imagine, you know, if my internal body temperature went up by 5 degrees rapidly, that would be a terrible thing.
Yeah, not great. And unfortunately, in Western Australia, we have had some devastating marine heatwave impacts. And so there's one location in particular, Shark Bay, and there was a marine heatwave that happened in 2010. And it's one of the largest seagrass meadows in the world in Shark Bay. And we lost about 25% of our seagrasses from the single marine heatwave event that happened. We lost 75,000 football fields worth of seagrass in that one marine heatwave event.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.